7:16 now, our friend Senator Pat Connick joins us. We're going to talk about tax reform in the state, but then 17-year-old Carlos Taylor escaped, and I know Pat's been all over this juvenile justice thing, so we thought we'd start with that. How you doing, Senator Connick?
Hey, good morning, Tommy.
Tell me about this latest escape, about the JJIC, how it relates to state law, what can be done, and a woman was carjacked in at the LSU Dental Center and more. Thoughts on everything.
Listen, we've been looking at this for the last few years, and one of the bills we passed in the legislature this past session was that if there's an escape, whoever has control over this juvenile must notify the media, must notify the police immediately, and then get the word out so they can get this whoever escapes back into custody. And the law requires the entity or the individual to notify within 10 minutes. And in this case, it was not done. So people are now aware of the law. Hopefully going forward, we can get things fixed.
He's still on the loose, as far as you know?
That's what I'm hearing. They have not called him yet.
And as I understand it, I think this kid carjacked somebody for the first time when he was 12.
It's a bad situation with this individual. You know, he needs help. And he escaped, and we got to get him back and try to get him help and go forward from there. But we have to do a better job of notifying the public and letting people know what's going on. And to keep this a secret doesn't work. It doesn't help anybody.
Pat, I say this again, like I told Mike Strain, not to curry favor with you because you don't need my endorsement, but I do know you well. You're a friend, and I know that you are a good guy, and you're not a lock him up and throw away the key kind of guy. That being said, you also have a responsibility to protect the public as an elected official. And I went over to the Juvenile Justice Intervention Center with Freddie King. I don't know if you know Freddie, fellow Shaw graduate, and met with some of the people that are there. And I pray for him every night. You don't want to paint everybody with the same brush, but you do have to protect the public. So, the kids that were sitting there in the round circle that we had, and I realize they're probably hand-selected to put the best front forward, and I don't have a complaint with that at all, but they all said they were happier to be there than they were to be out because they had some structure, because they were going to school, they felt safe. This is a big old problem, and it goes beyond just, and I know it's a concern of yours, not just from a leader, but as a guy of faith and as a guy that wants to do the right by everybody. We can take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back because this is a long-term solution, a big old giant problem. I don't know how you fix it. I struggle with it every night when I pray. I really do. So I want to talk to you about that when we come back, all right?
Yes, sir.
And you can come back and talk about tax reform some other time. Pat Connick, or maybe we'll get some time. Pat Connick, Louisiana State Senator, fellow Shaw graduate, proud to say. More when we return, 720 Traffic Now, WWL. 7:25, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Senator Pat Connick, who's been focused on juvenile justice and this for a long time, and the escapes from Avondale, and he is a good guy. I'm telling you, I know Pat for a long time, and no, seriously, Pat, and I know you're not. You know, somebody texted in and said, and let me just read it. That punk doesn't need, quote, help. He needs a prison cell. 17 years is old enough to know the difference between right and wrong. Keep him locked up till he turns 18, learns to read, then put him in boot camp. Well, listen to what you just typed there. He's 17 now. You say keep him locked up until he turns 18 and learns to read. That's a couple of months. And let a drill sergeant teach him how to behave properly. These kids, and being at the Juvenile Justice Center with our mutual friend and Char graduate, Freddie King, you know, I talk to these kids and they start, man, you know, they're saying that, you know, from the time they're four or five, sometimes the parents are in the house, sometimes they're not, sometimes it's siblings, sometimes it's the parents themselves that are teaching them how to get in a life of crime. So I know you as a parent and as a Christian, you look at it from the standpoint of kids that are four and five, and how do you fix that? You also look at it as this complex, layered problem of you can't treat everybody like a criminal, because if you do, then they start to think of themselves as a criminal. But you do have to protect the public. And this is one hell of a Rubik's Cube, Pat, and I don't even know how you go about beginning to solve it. Thoughts?
You know, Tommy, we've been working on this a long time. We fixed the problem at Bridge City. That took a while. The folks who escape, the folks who cause problem, they're going to get the media attention, and they're going to get the, all the you know, let's lock them up. They're bad actors, mm-hmm. and they are bad actors. They need to be locked up. But there's a lot of folks, a lot of kids that are getting help in the system, so we can't throw that away. We got to keep that focus on them to rehabilitate them and get them to be productive citizens. And I think we're going to do that to many, many of these juveniles. But, we, you know, there's a lot of eyes on the system now. The governor is really after this and trying to do the right thing. And I think we're going to get it right. This last incident shouldn't have happened. But because it happened, more and more focus is on what's the process of going forward. And the process is going to be on escapes. If they escape, notify the public immediately. Don't wait. And because we have a duty to protect the public. We don't want anyone hurt by these guys. Let's get them back into custody. And if they can't be rehabilitated, then you have to lock them up.
You always make the analogy of, you know, a contractor doesn't see walls in a house. A contractor or a plumber, electrician, they don't see walls. They see conduit. They see 2x4s. They see electrical boxes. And I use that as a metaphor because you, as an elected official, you know the problems of the juvenile justice system. You can't force people to be good parents. You can't legislate that. I don't know. What do you do for the kids now? And, Pat, this is what keeps me up, for the kids that are now 4 and 5 and going through what the kids that are at JGIC now that are 17 went through. So you're just funneling more into the system. How do you change that?
I don't know if you can, Tommy. There's always going to be an element of kids coming up with no parents, being born into a situation that's terrible. Now, we're lucky. I'm lucky to have a parent, two parents that love me and took care of me.
And Pat, let me ask you an honest question. Was there not something that you did in your life that could have gotten you in big trouble if you had continued down that road?
I have older brothers. I watched what they did, and I learned from them not to do things. So,
but you understand the point I'm making. It's all about opportunity and what we're exposed to, and but for the grace of God, all of us, who knows where we could be?
It's all about example. You know, you look at your family, you look at your faith, and do the right thing, try to do the right thing. Of course, you're going to mess up, but you always get that faith to go back on. But many people don't have that. And I realize that. And those are the ones we need to help if we can help. But if we can't allow them, those who harm people and rob and carjack and steal, you know, we got to take care of those in the right way. That's why we have jails. So.
Thank you, Pat. I appreciate your time and your efforts as a public servant. I really mean that. And I hope you come back and talk about tax reform one day, all right?
We need to change this.
And let me say this.
In the tax system.
Yeah, and let me say this real quick. If y'all ever have a chance to have Senator Pat Connick's grilled buttered potatoes at a fair, don't miss it because he makes the best in the world. Am I wrong?
They're pretty good.
Award-winning. Exactly. Thank you, sir. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Eric Smith about oil and gas. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Chris Miller. 7:44:16 till 8, in case you've not noticed, there's a presidential election going on and conflicting presidential messages. I Googled oil and gas production under Biden and Trump, and some of the results I got. Under both Trump and Biden-Harris, U.S. oil and gas production surged to record highs despite very different energy goals. Oil and gas production skyrocketed under both Trump and Biden. How will U.S. oil production hit a record under Biden? Big oil is doing way better under Biden than under Trump. Why oil companies are raking in record profits under Joe Biden? I don't know. Let's see what's going on with Eric Smith, Professor Eric Smith, a professor over at Tulane's Institute of Energy. How you doing, Professor?
I'm doing fine. How are you this morning, Tommy?
I'm very well, sir. Remember, you got to keep this on the 8th grade level so everybody understands, including me, all right?
All right.
Let's
we'll
talk about
it.
Oil is not oil, and I don't know how would you, from the economic standpoint, from the energy production standpoint, from the profit-making standpoint, how do you gauge where oil and gas production is now in the United States?
Well, one of the things that's happened in the last 10 years is we have become an oil exporter, and that means that there's a whole bunch of people out there that don't care what the president thinks, whether he's a Democrat or a Republican. We're actively participating in that international market. Some people are upset about it, particularly some of the Democrats. And what they've done is sort of used marginal policy, if you will, very short-term policy. We're in the middle of an election year. And they have done things like put pauses on LNG exports, which isn't strictly oil, but it is energy. They have talked about, they've certainly delayed pipelines and other infrastructure that you need to move oil and gas around. So in the short term, I would say that oil is setting records in spite of the government's effects rather than because of them.
So,
that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I know you and I have had conversations before about President Biden and a love-hate relationship with oil and gas. It seems as though initially in the administration he was trying to curtail that as much as he could, domestic production. But with, and then he kind of changed his mind when he realized, and correct me if I'm saying anything inaccurate here, that that probably wasn't going to work?
Well, I think he figured out... And I think both candidates are guilty of telling people what they want to hear. But
precisely.
When,
I want to be clear about that, too.
So when he's speaking out in California, his story is a little different than when he's speaking in Louisiana or Texas. And that's true of both candidates. One thing we need to worry about here in Louisiana is we are very, very dependent on energy as one of the or the main pillar of our economy. It represents about 160,000 jobs in the state out of about 2 million total. That doesn't sound like a lot, but they're the highest paying jobs we've got on average. So just the fuel sector, which would include some of the refining as well as the getting it out of the ground step, that's about 66,000 jobs. So it's about a third of our premium jobs are in the oil and gas area. You compare that to power, you know, our friends at Entergy and Clico, that's about 10,000 jobs.
Not only do what they say changes, sometimes their accent and tone of speech changes, Professor, depending on what area they're in. I don't know if you've noticed that at all or not. I say tongue-in-cheek. Let's talk about oil independence, because oil is not oil, and there's different types of oil that the refineries handle, correct?
That's right, and we've talked about that before. Basically, our Gulf Coast refineries are what we call complex refineries, and they're big. They're designed to basically process the cheapest oil they can find, which is usually heavy oil that's imported. We don't produce a lot of heavy oil ourselves, but it's imported. It takes a lot of processing, requires a lot of hydrogen to get rid of the sulfur in the oil, all those sorts of things. And that's the only kind of oil we really import anymore, is that heavy, sour oil. And the other side of the coin is that with the advent of all of the big shale plays, predominantly in Texas, like the Permian Basin, which spreads over into New Mexico, that's all relatively light oil, low sulfur oil. It's what the rest of the world needs because they don't have these big they don't all have these big complex refineries. So we've developed quite an export business for light sweet oil. At the same time, we're importing the heavy sour, or trying to, except most of the places we got it from are now under sanctions. So we're actually taking a hit in terms of our processing capacity because the refineries were, as I said, built to handle a certain amount of this heavy oil, and they're not getting it.
Is a sanction different than a tariff?
The sanctions are different than a tariff. A tariff says you can bring it in, but you have to pay a penalty. The sanctions say you can't bring it in at all, and if you do, we'll put you in jail.
Okay, that's a big difference. We'll take a break, pick it up here. We'll come back. I got a question about production on federal as opposed to private lands. I got another question coming in about if the government says one thing, but they ignore that, then what real role does the government have in all of this? Professor Eric Smith will continue to explain it to us in a way we can all understand. Professor at Tulane's Institute of Energy, a lot of candidates saying a lot of different stuff, as they are prone to do. 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:55, 5 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, trying to get the truth on oil and gas production in light of the presidential claims on either side of the aisle, Democratic or Republican. Drill, baby, drill. Oil independence. Let me go back to that for a second, Professor, if I can. Can the United States ever be truly oil independent or energy independent when it comes to the type of oil that we need, or would it involve rebuilding refineries? Take me through all of that if you can.
Yeah, I mean, we could. Technically, we're oil independent now because we're a net exporter.
Okay.
We export oil after we satisfy all our own needs. And the problem is this $1 trillion or so of invested assets that we've got that are kind of designed to run on one mix of oils, and you would have to change that. I mean, it wouldn't be that you would stop producing from the existing refineries, but they physically couldn't produce as much diesel and particularly the heavier products as they do today. So if you want to be energy independent, we can all pay more taxes and we can invest that in refineries, and those refineries will then be able to produce the same amount of fuel as they produce today. But it will be because we're running more of that lighter oil that we are currently exporting and less of the heavier oil that we're currently importing.
So it is not as easy as saying drill, baby, drill, accurate?
No, it isn't, because it's not. That's that's a great expression that came out of Belasco the last time around, but it's essentially not a drilling-constrained business. We can drill faster and much more efficiently than we were years ago, so that we can get as much oil out of the ground as we need. It's just you can't use that oil for anything. It has to go through a refinery and petrochemical plants to be put into a shape that you and I as a consumer can use it.
Let's talk about drilling on federal and private lands and percentage of each, or how I don't understand how that works.
Well, the basically all of the Indian reservations and all of the national parks, all of the land that's owned by the federal or controlled by the federal government has its own set of rules about drilling, and they are very lackadaisical in terms of their production because they're subject to so much political pressure. Most of our production comes from drilling on private land, and about the biggest concentration we have in the federal area is offshore, where you don't have any choice. It's either federal land or state land, but it's not your land. So that's where we do get a couple of million barrels a day of production that's on federal land, but the onshore federal land production is so tied up in red tape that it's at best stable production and usually declining. And people don't really even like to bid on it because of all of the restrictions.
Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time and your insight and your information. Eric Smith, Professor at Tulane's Institute of Energy. When we come back, we're going to talk to Dr. B, Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. It's Fall Prevention Awareness Week. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than one in four older adults fall each year. But many of those falls are preventable. And if those of you that have had elderly parents, as have I, know that a lot of problems start with people falling and breaking hips or shoulders or something else, and then that starts a cascade of failing health. So if you can prevent that, we'll talk about that when we come back. We'll also talk with Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council member, about the New Orleans City Council's Utility Council meeting and about the power outages that have happened. And currently, right now, they got some people, or at least as of 13 hours ago, some people that are without power. So we'll talk about it when we come back, WWL.